Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Mark Russo.
And I'm Tatiana Morani. Today we're discussing two very important topics, hunger and immigration. Our coverage features clips from the Make the Road rally last Tuesday, and WOOC correspondent Mark Dunley also talked with Tradiata Stampus from the New York City Food Bank.
After that, correspondent Aaron Pedinati talked with Tech Valley Center of Gravity director Holly Cargill Kramer about the future of that organization.
Then, correspondent Melissa Brownlee catches up with local musician Jonah Moberg about their musical craft.
Afterwards, we'll have Stanley Hatzel from Market Block Books in the studio with this week's book list. But first, let's get to our headlines.
The Manhattan Institute released a report on New York City's charter schools, examining the existing research on the city's charter schools and evaluating the policy implications for charter schools and traditional public schools alike. The report found that New York City charter school students perform better on math and English language arts tests when compared to their traditional public school counterparts. These findings appear to remain consistent over time as charter schools have expanded throughout the city.
With a population of over 8.5 million people, New York City is listed as the safest big city in America. The city's open data portal offers a variety of data sets about crime rates, public safety resources, and public safety agencies. The New York Police Department offers its own CompStat portal, where residents can access up-to-date information about crime in their neighborhoods and look at trends. The data can be filtered by patrol borough or precinct. Data sets in the open data portal include motor vehicle collisions and boundaries of police precincts. As the open data portal expands, city residents should send requests for data sets they think would be useful through the open data contact page, opendata.cityofnewyork.us.
Utica citizens are getting slapped with a 7.8% property tax hike after Mayor Robert Palmieri released his promised city budget for 2018. The nearly 8% increase crushes the property tax gap, and it will lead to $200 in added annual cost on a home assessed at $100,000. Palmieri pointed to mandated expenses, including retirement and pensions, long-term debt, salaries, and healthcare premiums that he says the city has no control over. Utica officials claim that 90% of the city budget goes to unfunded state mandates and contractual obligations like the ones we just mentioned.
The Troy Zoning Board of Appeals gave Dara Silberman and her Second Street farm stand, located at 492 Second Street, a use variance for a farm stand business in a community commercial zone. Silberman bought the vacant lot on Second Street from the city last fall to provide fruits and vegetables to her neighbors, friends, and family. Silberman hopes that she will be able to help feed children in the neighborhood fresh, healthy foods.
The Troy Record reports that Rensselaer County Sheriff Patrick Russo has announced he has signed an agreement to participate the Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement 287G program, despite widespread community opposition. Russo said his deputies will not be trained to do any immigration sweeps, and that only two of his correctional officers within the county jail will soon be trained to guard the ICE prisoners being held in the county jail. Rensselaer County is the only county in New York State participating in the program. The New York Civil Liberties Union has called on the governor to take action to prohibit any county from participating.
The White House on Sunday unveiled a new plan to prevent school shootings that backs off Donald Trump's support for increasing the minimum age for purchasing assault weapons to 21. The administration pledged to help states pay for firearms training for teachers and reiterated its call to improve the background check and mental health systems. His revised proposals were termed disappointing by the Brady campaign to prevent gun violence.
A coalition of nearly 200 environmental and community groups from across New York is urging Governor Cuomo and state lawmakers to ban plastic bags. Cuomo and lawmakers last year had blocked a New York City law regulating plastic bags from taking effect. Cuomo promised at the time to seek a statewide solution to plastic bags. The groups urged the state to adopt measures similar to those enacted by California, which banned the thin plastic bags frequently used by supermarkets and placed a minimum 10-cent fee on paper and thicker plastic bags.
Politico reports that the Cuomo administration will consider scrapping its plan to delay promised Medicaid reform for children, telling advocates on a conference call Friday that the reform is one of the top items the governor would like to restore in final budget negotiations with legislators. The reforms have already been delayed once. The new program would offer a slate of new behavioral health services, such as peer support and skill building for kids, and respite for parents. These wouldn't be provided to the most medically fragile children, mentally ill or developmentally disabled children, or children in foster care.
Two groups of New York millionaires, Patriotic Millionaires and Responsible Wealth, are urging the state to raise taxes on the wealthy to solve the state's $4.4 billion budget deficit. The two groups criticize the state for not meeting a court order to provide needy schools that were traditionally underfunded billions of dollars more in aid. The millionaires also focused on an underinvestment in social services, including the growing homeless crisis and infrastructure.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how you can be supportive of the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit our website at mediasanctuary.org.
Last Tuesday was a busy day at the state capitol. WOOC has a report about hunger in New York State, followed by coverage of the Make the Road rally on immigration reform.
We're talking with Triada Stampus, who is the vice president of the Food Bank for New York City, and she's up here in the state capitol. What are some of the hunger issues you're hoping to get the state legislature and governor to address?
Well, first and foremost is budget season, and so that's our primary focus. New York State is one of a couple dozen states that has an emergency food funding line, so we're here today with about 50 representatives from our network of food pantries and soup kitchens in New York City to advocate for an increase in funding for the state's emergency food funding program, which is called the Hunger Prevention and Nutrition Assistance Program.
Well, I believe among our friends we call it HPNAP. Has HPNAP seen any increase in funding in recent years?
It's been, after it received an increase about 3 years ago from the governor, it's been level funded since. And so what we would really like to see is for that number to continue to grow.
And how has the demand for emergency food over the last 3 years done? Has it remained level? Has it increased? Decrease? Has hunger ended in New York State?
If only. Our members continue to report elevated need at their food pantries and soup kitchens. One big trigger for it was the cut to SNAP benefits that took place in November of 2013, and the need really hasn't declined since. And we've looked at the numbers, and even though we're in a growing economy and a more buoyant economy, for people who are food insecure, they're in a deeper and deeper hole.
Now, I know you're up here today to lobby the state legislature for more funding for emergency food programs. How are you guys feeling at the federal level? And are you concerned about any of these new proposals on SNAP funding, food stamp funding at the federal level?
Absolutely. This is the most volatile environment in Washington that we've seen in a very, very long time. And the proposals that have come out of the White House, out of the House of Representatives, and out of the Senate all have had some pretty damaging provisions for SNAP, for what was formerly known as food stamps, now called SNAP, the first line of defense against hunger. So the White House budget that just came out a few weeks ago proposed a 30% cut to SNAP benefits and would make some pretty drastic structural changes that would take away the household's ability to shop for all the food they need and replace part of that with a standardized box of commodities. It's a very dramatic, drastic way to get at a really draconian cut of 30%, which would decimate the food stamp program.
And that was Triada Stampus, who is with the vice president of the Food Bank of New York City. So I caught up with Theo Oshiro, who is the deputy director of Make the Road, a very strong immigrant rights group, particularly from New York City. Theo, what are some of the issues you're trying to get the legislature to address this year?
Well, Mark, today we're here with many of our members, hundreds of our members from all over the state, because we are all here to demand things from our state and from our governor and legislature. And what we want, some of the key issues for us are very important things for immigrant communities, like driver's licenses for immigrant communities, healthcare coverage that will provide health access to many immigrants and low-income people across the state. And, you know, really key issues like the DREAM Act, which would help pay for college for undocumented young people. So these are issues that really matter to our base, low-income immigrants and other folks of color from across the state. And we're here today to really get the word out that these are the issues that most affect our communities and that we need to, our state to move on.
Now, as I understand it, the Assembly is generally supportive. The governor's been okay. How do you deal with the blockade, I guess, in the Senate to actually doing anything on immigrant reform?
Well, I think that all branches of our government need to really know that immigrants make up a large part of our population here in the state and are vital to our communities, to the fabric of our society. And so, yes, the Assembly has been supportive, and I think that it really time is running out for the Senate, for our governor to really move on issues like driver's licenses, like the DREAM Act, and like health care for all, because, you know, frankly, they are, for many people, life and death issues.
What are some of the health care reforms you're trying to get for immigrants? What have been some of the problems?
Well, as many people know, right, the Affordable Care Act that was passed by President Obama has been under attack. We know that also immigrant communities have been under attack. You know, folks that hold temporary protected status, for example, that's being in many cases rescinded. And so the result is not only an immigration matter, but also a healthcare matter. It means that many people could potentially lose healthcare coverage. So what we want is to make sure that folks like TPS holders, folks that are losing, you know, long-held legal status, do not also lose healthcare coverage. And the governor did take an important step to make sure that Dreamers, DACA recipients, could stay on healthcare here in the state of New York, and we want to see the same thing for TPS holders.
Now, unusually in New York, many, many issues now get rolled into the state budget. I know the DREAM Act's been in the state budget a couple of years, but it's been pulled out. If you're unsuccessful in pushing these issues to the state budget, do you have any chance of passing it during the rest of the legislative session?
You know, our focus right now is on the budget, right? We know that the budget is a key way in which many of our priorities can be passed. We know that it is possible to do it now in the budget, and so we really are focused on the budget. If that time comes when we need to keep pressing, we will explore and follow every possible opportunity to meet the demands of immigrant communities.
If people want to find out more about what your, you know, agenda is, get involved, how best can they connect with Make the Road and the overall coalition?
Yeah, we are obviously on Facebook and Twitter. Search Make the Road or at Make the Road New York. And our website is maketheroadnewyork.org.
Thank you. We're talking to Theo Shiro, Deputy Director of Make the Road.
Next, we hear from Irma Varios, who kicked off the rally for Make the Road.
Welcome you all to our first ever Make the Road New York's Democracy Day in Albany. Woo! Today, all of us are going to show New York State what democracy is all about. Ordinary people like us coming here together to fight for what is fair and for what is right. Working together, we can make our communities better and make our government more responsive of us, the people. Are you with me?
Yeah!
Today, with over 600 members of Make the Road New York from New York City, Long Island, and Westchester to present our Respect and Dignity for All New Yorkers platform and demand that the governor and legislator to provide these policies. Our platform will help protect all New Yorkers during the Trump era. The platform includes the New York State DREAM Act to ensure equal access to higher education, driver's licenses for all, fully funding critical repairs of the MTA, access to affordable housing, taxing the rich, and corporations to generate $6 billion in tax revenues to fund vital services, acting to end the school-to-prison pipeline, and ending the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers statewide. We need the governor and the state legislature to enact these policies that will benefit immigrants and the working class of New Yorkers of color this year. Time is running out before the state approves a budget, and we want our elected officials to take action now. So come April 1st, we see policies in place that will support and protect our communities. To introduce different leaders for Make the Road New York, who will share with you all what our priorities are for the state this year in our Respect and Dignity for All New Yorkers platform.
My name is Raina Andrew. I'm a member of Make the Road New York, a dreamer from Long Island, and a mother to a six-year-old boy. I'm here to tell Governor Cuomo to take action and stand up for our immigrant community by passing a New York State Dream Act licenses for all in this year's budget. Like most New Yorkers, I want to attend college. I want to have a good job to provide for me and my son. But I can't because I don't have access to the state's financial aid. New York must pass the Dream Act so that people like me can have the future we deserve in this state we call home. But just a Dream Act won't be enough for our immigrant community. On Long Island, there's a lack of public transportation. It takes us hours to get anywhere by bus, and taking the train could be expensive. Driving without a driver's license would put me in danger of being picked up and at risk of being deported, which would separate me from my son. Having a driver's license would mean that I could get to the store, take my son to the doctor, and participate actively in my community. I have received emergency calls from my son's school, and no matter how fast I would like to be there, I have to rely on someone else for transportation, which often makes me late. We need licenses for all, because driving and having a car in Long Island is a necessity. I have lived in this state for so many years, and I have seen pretty good things coming out of this government. But there is much more that could be done this year. We as Governor Cuomo and legislators, whose side are you on? Our community side, or are you on the side of those who attack us? Let's pass the Dream Act and driver's license for all this year. Thank you, everyone.
That was Triada Stampas of the Food Bank of New York City talking about hunger. For the Make the Road rally on immigration, we heard from Theo Oshiro, Irma Veros, and Raina Andrew. The story was filed by WOOC correspondent Mark Dunley.
Tech Valley Center of Gravity is a nonprofit located in Troy. WOOC correspondent Aaron Pednati recently sat down with its director, Holly Cargill Kramer, to ask her about the purpose, history, and future of the organization.
I'm Aaron Pednati, and today I am interviewing Holly Cargill Kramer about Tech Valley Center of Gravity. Holly is the executive director of Tech Valley Center of Gravity, a business incubator located in the heart of downtown Troy, New York. She has carried out over 25 years of executive-level service in not-for-profit management and communication with a focus on membership organizations, professional and trade associations, and higher education. As executive director of Tech Valley Center of Gravity, she serves as chief executive and operations officer, overseeing day-to-day operations, fiscal management, membership recruitment, and retention in governance. Holly, thanks very much for coming in for this interview. It's good to be talking with you.
Thanks again, Aaron. Appreciate it.
So to start out, can you tell us about Tech Valley Center of Gravity? What is it and what does it do in a general sense?
Okay. So it gets a little complicated. The Tech Valley Center of Gravity, at its heart, is a makerspace. It's also a prototyping center, business incubator, and creative community. As I try to explain it to most people, what we really are is if you wanted to have a variety, if say you were you wanted a workout and you wanted variety in your workout, maybe you have a stair stepper at home, then you want a little variety in your workout, you might join the Y, a not-for-profit organization where there's a lot of like-minded people and you have access to different equipment that you might not have at home so that you could use that and be part of that community, maybe take a class or two. Tech Valley Center of Gravity tends to be quite similar. You can join the Tech Valley Center of Gravity for a monthly membership fee, and based upon the level of membership fee that you pay, have access to at different times of the week to the equipment that we have in the building. We have 3D printers, a laser cutter, We have a fiber arts area. We have an electronics area, a model shop for small handwork. We have a full wood shop, metal shop, and welding shop in the facility. All of those are available to any of our full or super user members. In addition to that, we have a full community kitchen, a boardroom that's accessible to all our members, and a full classroom called the CEFQ Community Room. And those can all be booked for free by members for programs for which they do not charge admission. Yeah. We also have co-working membership that allows people to actually, people who maybe worked out of their home or work remotely or are trying to start up their own businesses to work within our facility, use the Wi-Fi, our digital printing center, our wide format printer and vinyl cutter, and also have access to the boardroom, classroom, and community kitchen as part of their membership as well.
And how does membership work? How do people become members?
Anybody can join. They can join online. We have super user membership is 24/7 and full access to any of the equipment for which you've taken a safety orientation. Full membership allows people to use the facility on nights and weekends. And then we also have an associate membership that allows you, once you can basically downgrade, if you've finished a project, downgrade to an associate membership to maintain your membership level and just use the facility for a $25 day pass. Co-working is $50 a month.
I see. So when did Tech Valley Center of Gravity get its start, and what sort of projects has it been involved in since then?
Well, It was born on Christmas Eve 2012 was when the incorporation papers were filed. It opened its doors originally on 4th Street in the lower level of the Uncle Sam parking garage. The founders were given a free month or a free year of rent from Bryce Properties in that place to see if they could make things grow from there. And the first day they signed up 125 members and knew immediately that they had already outgrown the space.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, so they began working with Bryce Properties, created a not-for-profit organization called the Quackenbush Building Corp. And the founders applied for grant funding through the New York State Department of Parks and Historic Preservation and through Empire State Development Corp. and Startup New York. And we're able to raise a significant amount of funds for the rehab of the building that Bryce Properties owned at 33rd Street. Our facility takes the first two floors of that, and the upper floors have been designed to have modular office space to allow startups to move up and grow through and hopefully out of the building into the rest of the region and grow.
Hmm. So given the intertwinement of Tech Valley Center of Gravity with the local technology sector, can you give us a broader sense of the history of the Capital Region's Tech Valley? How did the idea of having a Tech Valley in the upstate region first get off the ground, and how's it panned out over time?
Well, I actually happen to have some personal knowledge of that because I worked for the Albany Colony Regional Chamber of Commerce back in 1989-1991. When the Center for Economic Growth was coming to be, and in combination with folks at the Albany Colony Regional Chamber of Commerce, I think it was Wally Altes, who was president of the chamber at the time, that actually coined the phrase and said, California is going to have or has their Silicon Valley, we're going to have Tech Valley. And I think everybody in the room laughed at the time and thought it was pretty ridiculous. And all these years later, we're clearly seeing that growth. At the Tech Valley Center of Gravity, we're about to add to that tech-driven economy on March 21st, we're holding a ribbon cutting for our new prototyping center and business incubator that has been funded. The prototyping center was funded in part by Fuse Hub, a grant from them, and the Empire State Development Empire State Development Corp designated us a 16V business incubator and provided us with funding to launch that. And we're focusing on launching a manufacturing business incubator in the space to complement the technology, creative technology base in the facility.
And what do you think was the decisive factor in transitioning from this being kind of perceived as a joke, the notion of bringing a tech valley to upstate New York, to it actually getting off the ground to the point where it's something that's referred to in the media quite often and seems to have a certain level of public clout?
Well, I think that, you know, moving Semitech into the region, although, you know, those years ago, I mean, Semitech is gone now, but it was the beginning of it. And, you know, bringing that interest in chip manufacturing and nanotechnology that grew out of the Nano College at UAlbany and now continues to grow in the form of SUNY Poly. And a lot of work done by Empire State Development Corp to really convince people that this was a viable way to, you know, a viable place to grow that kind of economy.
Mm-hmm. To the point where GlobalFoundries has recently launched a major expansion of their plant in Malta.
Yep. And that digital game business that we talked about last week is continuing to grow in the region too, especially here in Troy. There's a really significant growing cluster in the game design business in the area. We're seeing a lot of virtual reality companies crop up, and it doesn't hurt us that we have probably no less than 15 major colleges and universities mm-hmm. in the area,
right?
And all the brilliance that comes out of that.
So, given what you just said, what do you see as the future of Tech Valley, particularly in terms of the types of businesses and technology production that it will attract here?
Well, I can't help but think that it's going to continue to grow and grow and develop. And I think that we are doing a good job here and have done in the past decade a good job of preparing ourselves for that growth. So we may not see some of the difficult growing pains that places like Austin have seen and that the Silicon Valley have seen. I think we're thinking a little bit more about how and really concentrating on how are we going to grow, what do we want to look like. And we've been paying attention to that for the last decade. And as long as we continue to pay attention to it, our growth will continue and that growth won't overrun us.
So thinking ahead, which is very important in technology industries overall.
Yeah. So absolutely.
Last question, what sort of projects do you see in Tech Valley Center of Gravity's near future?
Well, again, we're really excited about the ribbon cutting for our prototyping center. That prototyping center is going to allow people that have new ideas for hardware products that they want to grow and start a business in, to be able to develop their prototype right here in one place at a much more manageable cost than if they had to go to 3, 4, 5 different contractors to have those parts and pieces created and put together. And when you put that hand in hand with a manufacturing incubator that's going to help them grow a manufacturing business and mitigate risk in that growth, I think there's a lot going on there that we're going to see a lot of other new businesses grow out of that. Well, facility.
That sounds great. And thanks again for this interview, Holly. It's great talking to you.
It's my pleasure, Aaron. Thank you.
That was Holly Cargill Kramer, director of Downtown Troy's Tech Valley Center of Gravity.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Tatiana Morani.
And I'm Mark Russo. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check out our website at mediasanctuary.org.
WOOC correspondent Melissa Bromley recently sat down with another member of our WOOC family, Jonah Moberg. Jonah shared some music and spoke about their creative process.
I love learning more about the folks who are involved here at the radio station. People bring so many different things to the table. And it's been really great to get to learn a little bit about your music lately.
Thanks. Yeah. It's been funny being here for so long and never talking about it. It feels like a double life. But you're right. Everybody at the Sanctuary has a lot going on.
I was wondering if you would feel comfortable sharing some music with us now?
Yeah, I could play a song.
Saw you through the window, you were wearing my black dress in the snow, like a single apparition we were getting blessed. Going home. You've been making plans to get out of town. I'll be taking care. It's a long way down. Too ordinary, let push come to shove. Slow, taking time to notice I don't want to be in love. No. Forgotten people grow in a house of stone. When I leave the river, I'll be leaving it alone. And it's good to go.
Wow. That was so good.
Thanks, Melissa.
Quite a secret you've been carrying. So, how did you kind of find that sound? Were you inspired by particular musicians, or is this something that you kind of came to on your own?
Yeah. Well, I mean, as far as like the guitar playing goes, it's pretty much like I just went to a lot of bluegrass shows when I was a kid, and folk song, like folk shows and traditional music and stuff at places like Cafe Lina and different venues around the area. So that's kind of where my guitar playing came from. But I don't think it's, I know, I think I've managed to depart a little bit from bluegrass music. Nothing against it, but it's not what I'm doing. And I don't know. Yeah, my friends are the biggest influences on me, or have been. I've known a few wonderful musicians who've taught me a lot. And that's certainly the greatest source of inspiration for me.
And you have such a lovely singing voice. Were you always a singer, or is that something that you worked at?
I did like musical theater when I was in high school and stuff. And when I was a kid, I loved to sing. I remember always singing. It's not something that I ever like studied, but I think it's a lot of fun. And I usually sing before I speak on any given day.
That's nice. I like that. Do you have a process for making new music, or any sort of method that helps you?
There's no like tried and true method for me. Usually I write like late at night. When I like in the middle of the night is usually when I feel most creative. And yeah, it's just very slow. It's just, for me, it tends to be like piecing together little odds and ends from here and there, like over the course of maybe a couple of weeks to put a song together. And usually it's not till later on that I like understand exactly what they're like building into.
This particular song you just shared with us, does it have a name?
It's called Good to Go.
And did it come from any particular experiences?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, everything, in most of my songs, there's nothing that's, like, just made up. Mostly, usually, it's very, like, concrete images, even if they don't necessarily have so much to do with each other. So, in this one, it came mostly from, like, having been in a place of writing a lot of, like, heartbreak songs and things like that, and being kind of sick of it and wanting to, and also, and yeah, just moving toward a place of being, like, you know, happy with myself and finding some kind of, like, internal satisfaction. And so, yeah, it came from some experiences, some recent experiences with like an art project that some people I knew were doing that had a pretty profound effect on me, and then some like time I spent at your house in the woods walking around by the river.
Lovely. If folks who are listening want to hear more of your music, is there some place that they can?
Yeah, I have a Bandcamp, joankelsey.bandcamp.com, and so you can check that out. There's a few songs there right now. Maybe there'll be more. And then I should be playing some shows soon. I have one show coming up in Round Lake, which is a little town just north of here. It's a venue called the Round Lake Art House, which is really nice. And then hopefully some more shows around Troy in the near future.
So is that, just to clarify, J-O-A-N-K-E-L-S-E-Y?
Yeah, exactly.
Very nice. I know that you have other artistic outlets or creative outlets. Does any of that kind of play into the music?
I think so. Maybe indirectly. I like to make collages, and I think that some of my songs have an aspect of collage to them, like I was saying earlier about piecing things together and juxtaposing like images. And so, yeah, I think that comes through a little bit. And then I try to write lyrics that would stand up by themselves in a way. And I think that comes from having written poetry like years ago when I was a child and then kind of transitioning from writing poetry into writing song lyrics. So, yeah, it all comes together.
Do you have more plans in the future for writing music like this or music that is different?
Yeah, both. Yeah, so I feel as though I'm embarking on a new set of songs, which will be really interesting for me and exciting, kind of on that theme of like the really good parts of being by yourself and like the ways in which being alone and is like crucial. And yeah, so that's like my songwriting project. And then I've been making some like instrumental music, which I'm really excited about. And I've been playing with a friend of mine and just making the longest sounds we can. And it's been really fun.
I really love that idea of making music about being alone, because it does seem like a lot of music we hear centers around especially romantic relationships.
Yeah, it's true. And it's, yeah, and those are, it's kind of easy to fall into that trap of writing love songs over and over again, and also really hard to write good love songs. And so there's like a lot of bad music because people feel like they have to write about that. And yeah, I just started to feel bored by it, I guess. And also, like, it didn't have much to do with my life anymore. Like, I'm not pining and I'm not like heartbroken. I'm like, I think it's okay to be like satisfied in solitude. And I think there's a lot to say about that and a whole world of songwriting to be explored there.
Yeah. Kind of like a love song to yourself.
Yeah. Or a love song to the whole world, you know, which only comes through when there's not that one person there. Yeah.
Very cool. Thanks, Jonah.
Thanks, Melissa.
That was Melissa Bromley listening to WOOC's own Jonah Moberg share some music as well as some of what goes into making it. You can hear more of Jonah's music at joankelsey.bandcamp.com. And you can hear Jonah play live at the Round Lake Art House on Sunday, March 25th.
Once again, Stanley Hatzel from Market Block Books is with us in the studio. How are you, Stanley?
I am just lovely.
Well, that's good to hear. I'm looking outside. I'm noticing we can still see the sun, which is, I don't know, weird. Usually it's like super dark by now.
Welcome, change of pace.
It's refreshing. I'm so tired of the dark.
I heard that Florida was going to stop putting the clock back.
No comment.
I support that. We should just pick one.
That's weird. Like, Florida's the only state that would do this, and then everyone else in the country would be on a completely different time. Even everyone else in the Eastern time zone would be on a completely different time. It's just bizarre to me.
Florida's Florida.
You know, they do their own thing. It's okay. So, Stanley, what kind of books do you have us?
Well, I brought books to celebrate Women's History Month, so I have a bunch of tiny ones that really are more powerful than the bigger ones. And the bigger ones are pretty big.
Well, they really run the gamut from like record size to pocket size.
So I guess instead of don't judge a book by its cover, it's don't judge a book by its size?
That too.
They all have beautiful covers, I will say.
So I wanted to start out with, there's one I forgot. With a small manifesto by Mary Beard called Women in Power. It's really just two lectures that she gave. And the first deals with the story of women and voice. And she starts out with the story of, in the Odyssey where I've just forgot her name.
And those for you just tuning in, we're with Stanley Hatzell from ArcBlock Books. Stanley brings us a stack of great reads every week. And apparently this month is themed Women's History Month, or this week's rather.
Yes. So Odysseus and Penelope have a son named Telemachus. And Odysseus is gone out to sea on his journey. And Penelope makes a comment about the type of music that's being played. And then Telemachus, as the overbearing son, tells her to shut up and go up to your room and do some weaving or something. That's the beginning of Women and Silence. So this book really is the start of a conversation about where women find their voice. I think that's a piece of it. The interesting little sideline, some guy came in the store one day asking odd questions, and he picked up this book and started thumbing through it, and he said, "This seems like reverse evolution." I said, "Yeah, I think you might be misreading that." I said, "I think this is really the point of where evolution is taking us." And he suddenly scratched his head and said, I think I should get this for my girlfriend." And I'm thinking, he's in for trouble.
Oh, yeah.
He's in for big trouble.
Definitely.
So Mary Beard is the author of SPQR, which is the history of the Rome, the empire, and she's quite the historian. So this is her manifesto on women in power.
There's a lot of really beautiful artwork from ancient times, I think, to kind of outline these different misogynistic stories that we've had through history, which I think can be a really useful tool for dismantling those kinds of behaviors now.
Exactly. And really, the whole point of the books that I have here is to point out that history, as we have understood it, has not been honest and even in its coverage of all peoples, and certainly not women. So this is a chance to show how women's voices have been around through time. So the second book I brought is more contemporary, and it's Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, who wrote this letter to her cousin. Oh, I'm so bad. I have no memory today. So this is a series of points she wants to make to her relative about what to say to her daughter as she's growing up. And it's really a beautiful, sweet letter. And the first suggestion she says is, be a full person. And so she takes that point of you being a full person so your daughter sees that you are who you fully are and not who people expect you to be. And it continues in that line of awareness that you have to be who you are, you have to speak who you are, you have to name your daughter with a name that reflects who she is. And since she's Yoruba and from Nigeria, she thinks that the daughter's first name should be Nigerian, even though the husband is not Yoruba. So it's a little bit...
The title is Dear Ejeawele, or A Feminist Manifesto in 15 Suggestions.
It would have helped if I said that title, wouldn't it? Yes. Dear Ejeawele is how I pretty much say it. But it is a feminist manifesto, and she has these wonderful talking points. It's a very simple, elegant book, well spoken.
I like this phrase right here, beware of the danger of what I call feminism light.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting. I think even women all have very changing or disagreeing opinions on what is feminism and what it means to be a feminist.
I witness that on a regular basis at the bookstore, I have to tell you. I want to stay with the feminist theme a little bit more specifically. This is a graphic history of...
Perfect for radio. Thank you, Stanley.
It's the perfect brief history of feminism, and it is all historical and done in a graphic format. But it covers just about everything. It's very intense at times.
Mm. And, I should hope so.
But really, it starts out again with Penelope and Odysseus and the whole silencing of a woman's voice, and it even takes you through some up to contemporary times with the rise of Hillary Clinton and her running for public office, among other things. It's one that we saw a lot of.
Oh, really?
And it's published by MIT Press.
It's got some the drawings inside are very they're not incredibly complex and they're all black and white, but they're very powerful, stark imagery. Not quite cartoon, or maybe cartoony, cartoonish, or with caricatures to really show the different like positions of the different people. Which I like a lot.
They remind me of editorial cartoons that you would see in the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
That's the feel I get for that.
It's a good example.
And I'm going to stick with the graphic format. I have two more that are in the cartoon age, as we want to say today. Rebel Ladies Who Rocked the World. The book is called Brazen. It's by Penelope Bajou. And it's a series of mini biographies. I think there are, let's see, about two dozen in here. Everything from Margaret Hamilton, who played the Wicked Witch of the West, to Clementine Delay, who was this bearded lady in France, and how she refused to join the circus, but
yes,
really stood her ground.
I remember hearing about her, learning about her.
There's also a lovely piece on Josephine Baker. There is this terrific piece about Temple Grandin, who is the one who talks about kindness toward animals, and she's sort of an animal whisperer. There is also, who is it? Peggy Guggenheim, the woman who started the Guggenheim Museum. Take a peek at this. It's, again, these illustrations,
the texture of the cover is, I'm sure not the best part of the book, but is phenomenal.
It has a nice feel.
Yeah.
But they're very simple in terms of content. They're not really overdrawn.
They aren't.
Each panel is very clear and succinct. They really show you a lot in just a short few pages about the lives of these women.
I really appreciate that it covers women of different ethnicities. Because even just turning the page a few times, I'm seeing Asian women, I'm seeing maybe Hindu women, I'm seeing African American women. That's nice.
Yeah, yeah. So on a similar vein, I have this thing called the Little Book of Feminist Saints, and these are matron saints as opposed to patron saints. And they start, again, they cover the spectrum, and they include Barbara Jordan as one of the matron saints. And even Oprah makes it in here as one of the saints. My favorite, Maya Angelou. When I was in ninth grade, I read I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, and that book has stuck with me ever since.
I read that book in eighth grade.
Did you?
Yes. And did you know Maya Angelou is from Arkansas?
Nope.
I grew up in Arkansas, and they're like really, really proud of producing Maya Angelou.
I knew that when I read the book, but I've since forgotten it. But this really covers a gorgeous selection of women. And again, it's another history of women that is not necessarily told. Some of them are more obvious, some of them less obvious. There are a couple of mythic characters in there.
All right, we got Marlene Dietrich, who some people might only know because of her, like, the portrayal of a character similar to her in a Quentin Tarantino movie, right?
Oh.
But each of these women has their portrait and then a story, a paragraph, almost a page about their journey and their contribution.
And the artwork is really quite lovely of each of these women.
Truly.
There is one in there, and I'm blanking on her name, also a movie star, but also an inventor. Help me out. What's her name? She's in there.
Movie star and inventor?
Yeah, she actually invented the concept that is now used for Bluetooth and Wi-Fi.
That's fascinating.
I do not know this woman.
Yeah, she's in there. Look in the table of contents. You'll see it right away.
I feel like I should.
You should. There just was a book about her last year, and this is how my sorry brain works.
All this sunshine doesn't do the brain good.
Get me back to the dark.
Thinking times.
Maybe it's in the Brazen Book. I'm sorry. You'll know. It'll come to me after I walk out the door, and I'll say, oh, yeah, that's who I'm talking about. So she was helping during World War II come up with something like sonar, and in the process came up with this other technology that now we employ as part of Wi-Fi and Bluetooth.
That's amazing.
And Hedda Hopper. No, Hedda.
We have to Google it.
We should have a call-in moment. Because I'm just losing it right now.
Audience Wikipedia machine.
Yeah. If I had my phone with me, I'd say, so-and-so, text me right now with the answer.
Was it Hedy Lamarr?
Hedy Lamarr. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you to our engineer, Jonah Boberg, for Googling that for us.
So the next big book I brought you is called The Feminist Revolution and Struggle for Women's Liberation. This is a large format, bright red with a women's liberation power symbol on the cover. I love this. I went to see Jill Sobule in concert in the Hudson a couple years ago, and she had on this dress with this big women's power symbol on her chest, and it was like, I just loved her concert, and I love her. She blows me away. Do you know Jill Sobule?
No. Do you?
See, her claim to fame is she actually wrote the original song called I Kissed a Girl long before Katy Perry did. But she's written so much more, and she's kind of has a fun folk style, but political as well. Anyway, sidebar, Jill Sobule. So I'm going to let you look at this while I mention that this starts.
This book is very good for hitting microphones in our studio, apparently, as well.
Maybe like three times.
This goes into amazing detail. It looks like it's just going to be like a Life magazine coverage of the women's movement, but it's so much more, and some amazing historical photos.
So many beautiful posters from different events and stamps from different countries.
The protest posters alone are worth the cost of this book, so you can be inspired to write. Make some more your own. So there's one where the Oxford movement was going on, where the women were holding their first rally in Oxford, and all the men showed up to do daycare so they could participate in this rally. And there's a couple of photos of the men taking care of the kids while the women are doing all the hard work. I just love that. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous book.
I like the idea of that, too.
And I love that they have a chapter especially devoted to, as they say, black sisterhood and how civil rights was bound up with women's liberation in that movement as well.
I have an ongoing dialogue with a few customers who fall on the side of the white male history. And honestly, we're all raised with really lousy historical.
It's in all the books.
I know, yeah, and who wrote the books?
white guys.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, so I have these conversations, and I would love to be able to put a book like this in their hands and say, can you see history in a whole different light? But I don't really want to get into that kind of an argument with someone, because it would escalate into a confrontation.
It definitely would. But I do like the idea of, thinking about the way we teach history to children, and maybe this being a textbook rather than, I don't know, the usual textbook.
Rand McNally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Excuse me, I didn't mean to call out that particular publisher, but...
Don't they make maps?
Probably.
Well, this would be a cheaper textbook for sure.
Oh, it would.
Yeah, as opposed to,
And great pictures.
Yeah.
I wonder how much freedom schools have to choose their textbooks, or if any.
That's
depends on the school, probably.
And the politics involved. But I'm sure someone's got their toe in the door to make sure you buy their product.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Lobbyist. You've got a book that's got some food on it.
I have to end with a food book when we're ready for a food book. But this is the the simple food book to end all food books, and it's all about hummus. I am all about hummus, and I will let you touch it while I talk about hummus.
Thank you.
You know, hummus doesn't have to just be made with chickpeas. You can use just about everything in your hummus, and here is Stanley's.
Could you make avocado hummus? Because a lot of these kind of look like avocado toasts.
Yes, you can. Oh. Somebody said to me, you know there's avocado toastness, and they're going to talk about that with you when you're on the air.
Exactly.
Because someone in this room, I won't say who, accused me of being a millennial, as if that's a bad thing, because I eat avocado toast. But yes, anything can go into your hummus, and it doesn't have to be chickpeas. Today, or this week, I've been making every type of hummus you can think of, from spinach to bok choy to smoked paprika hummus. And sometimes I put a lot of sriracha in it because I like hot and spicy foods.
Do you think that using fresh chickpeas versus like canned chickpeas affects the taste of the hummus?
No. Unless you're buying really cheap, crappy chickpeas.
Do you ever use your chickpea water other things?
You can make meringue out of chickpea water. That's called aquafaba.
Uh-huh, because I think, I think faba means like bean.
Right.
It just means like bean water.
Yeah, you can whip it up and make it into meringue.
I heard you can use it to make mayonnaise, too.
Yeah.
Big vegan mayonnaise.
You are the man. But so you can do roasted red peppers, roasted beets, roasted pumpkin. I've made pumpkin hummus. I've made beet hummus. I've made avocado hummus. You know, the sky's the limit when it comes to hummus. So this book is a really good...
curry spiced hummus?
I'm telling you.
That sounds like the bee's knees.
The possibilities are endless. So that's a great note for us to take going into next week. Thank you so much, Stanley, for joining us and bringing both Women's Liberation and hummus into the studio.
Hummus has to be there.
Thanks. Well, that about concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Russo.
And I'm Tatiana Morani. I want to also thank our engineer, Jonah Moberg. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every other weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m., to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose by checking into our online streaming at mediasanctuary.org. And also, we post stuff on our Facebook page, so check that out as well.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.